Case number 24-1179, Minnesota Telecom Alliance versus Federal Communications Commission et al. And the 14 other petitions for review consolidated in this court pursuant to 28 U.S.C. Section 2112, subsection A, subsection 3, and the February 9, 2024 order of the United States Judicial Panel on Multi-District Litigation and MCP number 177.
Very good. Let's see, Ms. Ratner. You're up.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Morgan Ratner for the industry petitioners. The Commission's digital discrimination rules pile overreach on overreach.
That You're starts. Have to speak up.
Just get closer.
You can move the lectern. You can put the.
Sure. That starts with the scope of the discrimination ban. Congress used the words discrimination of access based on protected characteristics. That's classic disparate treatment language. And just as importantly, Congress did not use familiar disparate impact language, including from the Supreme Court's recent decision in inclusive communities. But the Commission has gone ahead anyway and has adopted an unprecedented disparate impact scheme that is in many ways the broadest the federal government has ever seen. And things only get worse from there. The Commission applies its rules not just to broadband providers, but to a host of other entities, from landlords to contractors. It covers every possible term of service, from advertising to pricing to deployment to any other number of terms. And to top it all off, it applies its full gamut of remedies, including punitive fines, without a word from Congress. None of that is a plausible understanding of what Congress did here. This is an ordinary non-discrimination provision attached to $65 billion of federal funding. It is not an unprecedented grant of authority for the agency to adopt the broadest civil rights program we've ever seen. Well, let me start then with the most glaring error here, we think, which is the lack of disparate impact language in the statute. The key decision here is inclusive communities. And there, the Supreme Court laid out three indicia for finding a disparate impact scheme. The key portion of the opinions is at pages 534 to 535. And in that portion, the court says, first, there must be results-oriented language in the operative text. That includes language like adversely affect someone or make something unavailable to someone. We don't have that here. We have only a ban on discrimination. Second, in every disparate impact case, there has been an initial ban on disparate treatment, followed by a broader catch-all provision catching disparate impact. In other words, widening the lens. We don't have that here. We have a unitary ban on discrimination. And third, the court said, there's been key language, otherwise make unavailable, otherwise adversely affect, that signals what the court said is a shift from disparate treatment to disparate impact. We don't have that language here. That was language the court said was of central importance in inclusive communities, and before that, in the court Smith case about the ADEA, that's the language the Supreme Court put in italics. But the Commission is 0-3 on those signals here, and I think no reasonable congressperson would say, I'm going to enact a statute, I'm going to say discrimination, which is something the court has repeatedly said means differential treatment, and then I'm not going to include any of those three signals, but I will include a broad goal of equality, and that will be enough to get us to disparate impact. That's just not a plausible reading after inclusive communities.
Well, they had to adopt a rule, right? Rules, I'm plural. They had to adopt rules, right?
That's correct.
What do you think the rule should say?
So this rule, the rule authorized in B1, which is the provision that the Commission acted under, is that the rule should say that digital discrimination of access means differential treatment on the basis of the protected characteristics. Now, the commission may be able to enact other rules as well, and I'd point you to Joint Appendix pages 84 to 87, where the commission considered a host of other things it could do to further equal access, things like additional outreach, commission restructuring, action on tribal lands, better mapping, and the like. It could do plenty of other things as well, but what it couldn't do is change the language in B1, which is, again, prevention of discrimination based on these protected characteristics, into a disparate impact provision. That's something that you would need authorization from Congress to do. And I do want to emphasize that this is not unusual at all. This is attached to, again, $65 billion in federal funding. This is a routine thing that Congress does when it hands out federal funds, is say, and by the way, there shouldn't be disparate treatment. Our partners in many of these endeavors have to behave well. And Congress did that actually three times in the same division of the same act. So we're talking about the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. In Division F deals with broadband. This is the third of three non-discrimination provisions in Division F. And the other two, which the commission accepts at page 37 of its brief, are different disparate treatment provisions. So we've got two disparate treatment provisions for some funding programs. We've got an additional disparate treatment here for additional funding programs. There's nothing extraordinary about that reading of the text. That's a reasonable understanding in light of, again, these funding provisions.
Counsel, those defending the rule say that a rule, as you've described, that covered only disparate treatment would, in effect, do nothing. What's your response to that?
Sure. So, Judge Grantz, I'd say a couple things. First, that theory is hard to reconcile with the other two provisions I just mentioned that are also disparate treatment provisions in the same division, and the commission accepts are appropriately construed as disparate treatment provisions. Second, I think as a practical matter, Congress includes these sorts of prophylactic provisions, whether it's a significant problem or not, purely as a fact that it's giving out those substantial sums of money. And third, I think that, if anything, that cuts the other way, because in the very rare circumstances where the Supreme Court has allowed disparate impact, it has emphasized that this is an extreme remedy that Congress has adopted following on the heels of a long period of disparate treatment, a long period in which disparate treatment was not enough to solve that problem and disparate impact was added. So I think, if anything, that suggests how aberrational it would be to have a disparate impact scheme without that type of history of disparate treatment.
But these clauses are not tied to the money, right? They're general policy of the United States.
It's correct that these are not tied to the money, but I think that that makes sense in the context of the structure. And again, it's a 1,000-page bill, so bear with me a little bit. But you have, as I said before, Division F dealing with broadband. You have Title I is the BEAD program and includes a non-discrimination provision at the end. Title III is what's called the Digital Equity Act and includes a non-discrimination provision. And this appears in Title V at the end of a program called the Affordable Connectivity Program that gives out essentially subsidies for low-income individuals to get their hands on broadband, and is something that has been throughout the industry applied to virtually all broadband providers. So given the reach of the Affordable Connectivity Program and the way that funding was channeled through individuals selecting their subscribers, it's not surprising to me that Congress would say, let's just add an industry-wide non-discrimination provision as well. So I think all of those are reasons why we're right on the text straight up. I do think that the commission has an even higher hurdle to clear here because, as an alternative, the court could construe this as a major questions case. And really, we're in kind of the perfect storm of major question circumstances here. We're not just saying that this is an important industry or a disparate impact provision. What we are saying is this is a disparate impact provision that has been construed to be the single broadest disparate impact provision we've ever seen because of the inclusion of income level. And just to put a sort of real-world effect on that. Disparate impact that includes income level picks up virtually everything a business does. A provider decides to lay cable or build a tower in one neighborhood before the next, to put an ad on one TV channel instead of another, to hire one additional technician, one additional customer service representative, to give a promotional discount to new customers or existing customers. Every single one of those things is likely to have a disparate impact based on income. And then all of those just go to the commission, where the commission gets to decide, does it think that that policy is justified? And the way it decides whether it's justified is not just a pure look at profitability or anything objective. Instead, it gives a range of non-exclusive factors at page 37 of the joint appendix, cash flow, return on investment, income, expenses, and others. It's going to take a look at all of those. It's going to decide if somebody's action is within acceptable ranges or whether a provider's pursuit of profit needs to be balanced differently with the commission's calculus of digital equity. That is an awesome power, a power that no other federal agency enjoys. And if that power is going to be applied to an important American industry through a provision that had no debate, a provision that was tacked on to the end of a spending bill, then that's exactly the type of circumstance where the Supreme Court has said, we're going to require Congress to speak clearly. And so either as a matter of the text straight up, or viewed through that major questions doctrine lens, we think those are two alternative paths to saying that this is impermissible here.
Does your major questions doctrine argument depend on the regulation of non-ISPs under the rule?
It does not depend on that, but I do think that there's an additional factor, additional piece of the major questions doctrine here, which is that the commission acted as broadly as possible across all dimensions. I mentioned income, but it also acted as broadly as possible in terms of what services are covered and, as your honor's question indicates, who is covered. It covered not just providers, but it covered landlords, contractors, maintenance workers, and the like. And it said that any of these individuals are subject to commission regulation if the commission determines that they meaningfully affected access to broadband. That is something that also we have never seen before. I would expect if the Federal Communications Commission is going to have authority to regulate all of these other entities, then there would be something in the text, something in the legislative history, something in the focus of the statute to put an emphasis on those other providers. So we do think that's part of the overarching major questions doctrine. We think that could also be construed, if you disagreed with us on disparate impact, as a way to exclude those non-broadband providers from the regulation as a bare minimum. Another way in which this applies as broadly as possible is in the remedial provision. The commission says we have full remedial authority using any of our powers in the statute to enforce these new disparate impact based on income rules. And it's pretty remarkable that it says that given that four provisions up, section 60502 of the IIJA. In that provision, Congress did give the commission express enforcement authority. Here it says it's all implied, and we're going to infer every available remedy, including punitive forfeitures. So I think across every frontier, who is being regulated, what that regulation is backed up with, what is the scope of the regulation, the commission across every dimension has pushed as broadly as possible. Again, we think the simplest way to say that that is a problem is just looking to inclusive communities, looking to the plain text here, saying that the plain text here invokes disparate treatment, not disparate impact. But all of these extreme consequences, I think, buttress that same result.
Ms. Ratner, the petitioners have raised numerous challenges to this rule. Does the rule stand or fall as a whole? What if the court disagreed with you on some of the arguments but agreed with you on others?
Yeah, so we have argued that these are independent bases for rejecting the rule, or really setting aside the rule according to the language of the statute. And the Commission has never argued otherwise. It's notable it doesn't include a severability provision in this order, even though it does in other orders. For example, the Title II proceeding that is currently before the Sixth Circuit. I think if the court doesn't want to even think about those severability type questions, the simplest way to decide the case is on the disparate impact ground, because there's no way to read this regulation and think that the coverage of disparate impact is severable from anything else. That's the heart of the rule. So if you decide on that ground, then we think that that causes you to set aside the whole rule. You don't have to reach the other grounds, although we think they're good supplementary alternative grounds, and you don't have to reach the arguments from the public petitioners from whom you'll hear next. If there are no further questions, I'd like to leave time for the public interest petitioners and then preserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
That's fine, yeah. The clock will keep running, yes. So when 30's gone, it's gone.
Yeah, thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Epstein, and I represent public interest petitioners and interveners. My colleague, David Brody, will later present arguments regarding why the court should affirm the majority of the order, including its disparate impact rules. I will address two limited deficiencies. The FCC's decision not to provide digital discrimination victim.
Whose 30 minutes does Mr. Brody count against?
His counts towards the FCC. He'll be taking 7 minutes of the FCC's time as well.
Well, that's up to them. I've just told you the rule. When 30 minutes is done, your team is done.
Understood. Thank you, Your Honor. I will address two limited deficiencies. The FCC's decision not to provide digital discrimination victims the right to file formal complaints, and its decision to include a presumptive safe harbor for recipients of broadband equity and access deployment program funding. First, the FCC did not reasonably explain its decision to decline to afford digital discrimination victims the right to file formal complaints, and it did not respond to significant comments urging them to do so. In Section 60506, Congress directed the FCC to issue rules that would promote equal access to broadband, and in Subsection E, to revise its public complaint process. The FCC's complaint process generally allows the public to file both informal and formal complaints. Informal complaints merely allow individuals to file something. In other words, a victim tells the FCC about an allegation of discrimination, and the FCC decides whether or not to investigate. Formal complaints, however, allow victims to pursue claims regardless of the FCC's decision of whether or not to investigate.
Well, of course, counsel, you know it doesn't say formal complaints. It just says the word complaints. What level of deference in these days of semi-deference, what level of deference do we owe to their reading of the statute?
Well, under Loper-Bright, Your Honor, which my colleague may address later, the FCC is still afforded an amount of deference because of the delegation of authority to the FCC by Congress. But
its reading that the word complaints can be informal, formal, oral, through the telephone, you know.
Our argument is about the FCC's explanation in the order, not about its interpretation of the rules. And in the explanation,
aren't they the same? I'm not arguing for the sake of arguing, but aren't they the same?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
The explanation needs to be reasonable regardless of its interpretation. The APA requires that it provides reasonable explanations.
Well, counselors, you know they think it's best for consumers. You've seen their arguments.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah, they think that informal complaints are best for consumers. That's their main argument, I think.
The FCC only provides reasons as to why the informal complaint process is sufficient. But it doesn't explain why it doesn't provide these additional formal rights that would be that victims would be entitled to in a formal complaint process, like discovery, the opportunity to participate in settlement negotiations, and saying that it is good, for instance, for victims to easily and informally tell the FCC about a claim of discrimination doesn't explain why the public should not have the option to participate in that more formal process. And in paragraph 72 of the NPRM, the FCC even describes what it should have taken into account, like whether it would be accessible, a formal complaint process that is effective or unduly burdensome, and whether the burden outweighs any benefits. And that's at appendix 297 to 298. But the FCC did not address any of these issues in the order, and it explicitly declines to address the issue of burden. The FCC only gives one reason why it did not provide the right to formal complaints. It says it agrees that with Verizon that informal complaints satisfy the requirements of Section 60506 and provide the necessary functionality for the commission to carry out its duties. But as public interest petitioners demonstrated in their opening brief, an FCC failed to contest in its opposition. Verizon said no such thing, and even wrote that in its view, the commission's formal complaint process would remain available for instances where use of it is appropriate. Next, I will address FCC's lack of adequate notice that it was considering a presumptive safe harbor for recipients of BEAD funding, and the lack of reasonable explanation for its decision to do so. Up until the order itself, a presumptive safe harbor for recipients of BEAD funding was not on the table. The concept was not even raised until NTIA proposed the idea at the 11th hour on October 6, 2023, over 9 months after the NPRM. And the NTIA did not even cite a provision of the NPRM to which they were purportedly responding. The FCC's October 25th draft order then rejected the idea. In fact, FCC's only mention of BEAD in the NPRM is in paragraph 85, in which they ask whether they should apply their digital discrimination requirements to BEAD, in other words, to strengthen BEAD's non-discrimination requirements. Nowhere is there any indication of the opposite, that FCC was considering weakening its own. Indeed, in this court's 2018 decision, Citizens Telecommunications Company of Minnesota v. FCC, this court rejected the notion that any mere mention of a subject or issue is sufficient notice.
Counsel, is that case anchored in Chevron?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay, tell me why it isn't. It reads like it is, but...
Citizens Telecommunications Company of Minnesota deals with the FCC's... It deals with a provision that was inserted late into proceedings, and the court holds that the mere mention of a subject or issue under the APA is not sufficient notice, which I don't believe is a Chevron issue. Finally, the FCC did not reasonably explain its decision to provide the presumptive safe harbor.
What's your best Eighth Circuit case on that as reversible error, so to speak?
I believe that would be Red River Crossing as well, which supports public interest petitioners' other argument. But I see that my time has elapsed.
Well, the only thing I see in the part of the brief that I think is addressing that is an Eighth Circuit case that's a mere 39 years old.
I believe you're referring to Minor.
Something since then with Heckler, so that was probably a Social Security case.
It's a basic requirement under the APA that the FCC provide a justification for its decision. It can't just merely say...
There aren't too many circuit court cases that have rejected an agency decision because you didn't explain it well enough. Maybe the D.C. Circuit's done it a few times, but we haven't.
I believe in Red River Crossing and Menorah Medical Center, the court rejects the explanation in both cases and would support our argument.
Rejecting is one thing, not adequate is different.
In both cases, I believe this court says that the explanation is inadequate. In Red River Crossing, the decision has to do with an agency's failure to choose between two options, and the FCC does not provide an adequate explanation, which is very similar here. And I see that I've gone past the time that I've taken from petitioners. So the court has no further questions. Thank you.
Wait. Good afternoon. May it please the court, Jacob Lewis for the FCC in the United States. The best reading of the anti-discrimination provisions of the Infrastructure Act is that it covers disparate impact as well as disparate treatment claims. Congress and the FCC have long been concerned with closing the digital divide.
Did you say the best interpretation, or did you say that's what the statute says?
That's the best reading, Your Honor. That's the best reading, giving no deference to the commission at all. I'd like to walk the court through the statute for the results-oriented language that inclusive communities look to in determining that the Fair Housing Act covered disparate impact. So, in the first place, Section 60506B instructs the commission, shall adopt final rules to facilitate equal access to broadband internet access service, and including among those rules, preventing digital discrimination of access, that word access again, based on income level, race, ethnicity, color, religion, or national origin. The statute defines equal access for purposes of the section means the equal opportunity to subscribe to an offered service that provides comparable speeds, etc. These terms, access and equal opportunity.
I didn't get, what was the number?
I'm sorry.
I'm looking at 1754.
So I was first referring the court to 1754B. Says adoption of rules. That's where the.
You said 60506.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor. There's two ways to refer to this provision. It was a 60506 of the Infrastructure Act, but I'm happy to refer to the codified section. Section 1654B is what we were talking about. That's where Congress instructed the Commission to adopt rules. What were those rules? Adopt final rules to facilitate equal access. What's included in them? Rules preventing digital discrimination of access. What did the Congress mean by equal access? Well, in 1754A2, Congress said the term equal access for purposes of this section means the equal opportunity to subscribe to an offered service that provides comparable speeds, etc. So the terms I want to focus the court's attention on are equal opportunity and equal access.
I'm looking, I think you're reading A2.
A2 is what I went from, when I went from B, I went to A2 because A2 has the definition of equal access. And my point
is. What's the E then?
E?
Now you just said you went from E to A.
No, I'm sorry, B, Your Honor. B as in boy.
So where is the B?
The B.
That's adoption of rules.
What, excuse me? Adoption of rules, right. Well, I guess what, let me walk it through again. The first instruction that Congress gives to the Commission is adopt rules. And that's in B, as in boy, 1754B. And what are the rules the Commission is supposed to adopt? Rules to facilitate equal access. That's an important term. And again, it says including rules to prevent digital discrimination of access. That's all in B. And then the reason we look to A is A defines equal access to mean equal opportunity. My point is that equal access and equal opportunity are the kinds of result-oriented terms that inclusive communities points to.
Counsel, is it watered down by the fact that you left out the clause, taking into account the issues of technical and economic feasibility presented by that objective?
Now,
does that water it down?
I'm glad you raised that phrase, because I don't think it waters things down. Actually, that's my second point. It does say twice, it reminds the Commission, take into account considerations of technical and economic feasibility.
Those considerations are at the heartland of disparate impact litigation, disparate impact claims. They're not irrelevant to a disparate treatment claim in certain circumstances. But if you have evidence of intentional discrimination, you're not going to be able to defend on, well, it wasn't technically possible not to discriminate, or wasn't economically possible not to discriminate. But disparate impact claims, technical and economic feasibility, are part of the business justifications that the court has recognized are part and parcel of disparate impact claims. So we not only have the statutory markers of equal access and equal opportunity, we have this other statutory marker of technical and economic feasibility, a consideration that applies more neatly with disparate impact claims. So we're just looking at the statute here to try and figure out what Congress meant when it instructed the Commission to adopt rules preventing discrimination. Those are two indications that what it meant was to include disparate impact. There's a third one. This statute is written without reference to a particular actor whose intent could be measured. It just says to the Commission, prevent discrimination. Doesn't say by whom, and that it doesn't measure, it doesn't identify somebody whose intent could be measured. That's another indication that Congress was not looking at solely at intentional claims of intentional discrimination, but also looking to claims involving disparate impact. This is entirely consistent with inclusive communities, which went through this same analysis, looking to the statute as a whole to see whether there were indications about Congress's and what Congress's meant when it instructed the Commission to adopt rules to prevent discrimination. And Judge Gratz, I think you asked my opposing counsel the question about, well, was there any evidence here that there of a problem with intentional discrimination? And she didn't say that there was. The record showed no suggested, not contain a suggestion that there were obstacles to access to broadband internet service that stemmed from intentional discrimination. So if this statute were limited to intentional discrimination, it would not do much of anything. And usually we presume when Congress goes to the trouble of passing a statute, instructing an agency to adopt rules to prevent something, that it means to be accomplishing a task that has some significance, not a task that doesn't have any kind of significance.
Of course, A is entitled Statement of Policy.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but there's a definition in there. We're pointing to the definition. First of all, the Statement of Policy can inform and should inform the court's interpretation of what comes just in that very next section. But actually, that definition, even though it's in a statement of policy, is just as much a definition if it had been placed anywhere else in the statute. The term equal access.
And then B, which is adoption of rules, says preventing digital discrimination.
Of access. And that access is the access that is referred to twice before in the preceding sections of the statute. We don't have any. In B, it says equal access, and in A, too, it defines equal access.
Well, it's kind of like some of the ADA exceptions to defining discrimination, intentional discrimination. Well, but it's sort of like an affirmative defense. If you base it on technological feasibility, there's no evidence of discrimination from that.
Well, but if you had independent, and again, I'm not saying that it doesn't have some relevance to it, but technical and economic feasibility considerations are really part and parcel of a disparate impact claim. It's the combination of all of these things.
You don't have a statutory. I mean, you can say that. It's a nice ipsa dixit, but I don't know another statutory context that's analogous that supports that directly.
No, Your Honor,
except maybe the ADA, which is not favorable, I think, to your argument.
Well, but, Your Honor, that's not our technical and economic feasibility considerations, not the only textual marker here. Primarily, equal access and equal opportunity look to results. Have equal access and equal opportunities been preserved? It doesn't look to an intent, doesn't say by whom, doesn't say in which way, in any way. That's what Congress was saying. Preserve, facilitate that kind of access.
Well, they're saying don't let anybody discriminate.
Well, they're saying don't let discrimination happen, and I think that makes a big difference when
But the word discrimination contains a treatment, an intent.
I don't think so,
it's
Your Honor.
It's inherent in the word.
There are the statutes in the federal code that include disparate impact claims, Title VII, the ADA. They all have the word discrimination in them. You can discriminate by policies and practices that have a disparate impact.
But their IPC went through pages and pages explaining the unique provisions in Title VII and the FHA that led to the exceptions recognized in those cases. And you're saying, oh, no, that language, that's not an exception at all.
Well, the language was slightly different in the Fair Housing Act, and nonetheless, the Supreme Court said it included disparate impact claims. Congress isn't forced into a particular set of magic words when you're talking about this. The question for the court is to read the statute and come to the best conclusion about what Congress meant. And our point is, when you look at equal access, equal opportunity.
One of my assumptions is Congress acts understanding the judicial precedence of the language it's considering and debating often.
Well, but
the magic words, if you will.
But I think that's exactly our point. Congress does.
Well, you're counting on the three exceptions in the universe and putting aside or not telling us, don't worry about why the Supreme Court, what the Supreme Court found in those statutes that was unique.
Well, but I think what our point is with the Supreme Court's message in inclusive communities was for courts to look at that results-oriented language because that's what identifies disparate impact cases. And that there's a world of ways in which Congress can express results-oriented language. And our point here is this statute contains those markers. I'd like to make one other point with regard to the delegation point. So even after Loper Bright, obviously Chevron has gone by the wayside. But the court emphasized in Loper Bright that if the best reading of the statute is that Congress delegated to the agency the task of interpreting, then that the court should respect that delegation. This seems to me that there's a powerful argument here that Congress delegated to the commission the task of defining discrimination because it instructed the commission to adopt rules. By the way,
Counselor, if we're at that level of the world, you're aware of the flat statement, I know you both rely on the same case, that says disparate impact liability must be limited so employers and other regulated industries are able to make the practical business decisions and profit-related sustain a vibrant and dynamic. They claim that's what the precedent says, and they're affirming it again here. If we're at that level of the analysis, why does that sort of consideration control?
So the commission interpreted that statute says technical and economic feasibility. The commission interpreted that to include any legitimate business justification. And I think Congress was really specifying, using technical and economic feasibility, was specifying the kinds of legitimate business considerations that inclusive communities said were important to be able to defend against charges.
Well, you added the word genuine in there.
Well, I think,
you know,
Your Honor,
which is a country phrase in some subcultures of America that means I don't really know what you're saying.
Well,
and you did add the word genuine before Congress's words. You think I have the authority to add genuine?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the commission, when it observed genuine, it just wanted to exclude the possibility that somebody might come to it with something that was in form a technical or economic feasibility consideration. I'm putting those terms in air quotes, but wasn't really a serious proposition. And that's all the work genuine is doing. Don't come to us with some made-up consideration that doesn't
matter. Did the FCC say why they included that word? It's glaring in my way of looking at it.
I think that's why they did. I think the order explains. They put the word genuine in there to make sure that businesses weren't going to be encouraged just to say to to state the word this is a technical consideration or this is an economic consideration without the commission having the ability to examine whether there was any meat behind that, any basis for it. But Your Honor, even if you took the word genuine out,
which it should be, go ahead.
Then fine. I think the statute still operates the same way, that the businesses have the ability to raise any legitimate technical and economic.
Now you're going to use legitimate. Go ahead.
Well, I use legitimate, Your Honor, because in the world, I think there's a background principle that the dialogue between the regulated party and the commission has to be that on the basis of legitimate considerations. But let me stop with any of the qualifiers.
Proceed.
Let me say that the fact is, if Your Honor wants to say it's unqualified technical and economic mm-hmm. feasibility, I think that's, as a practical matter, all the commission was saying, right. that businesses certainly have the ability to come to the agency and explain, no, the reason we have this policy in practice is because of this technical consideration or this economic consideration. It's not technically possible for us to deploy in this way. It's not economically possible for us to get there. And that the Congress understood that that was something the commission had to take account of, and it takes account of in the rules. So this idea that somehow that the commission's rules will upset business practices just ignores that aspect of the commission's analysis, where the commission is obligated to take account of those technical and economic considerations. If I might just say a word about the major questions doctrine, because the major questions doctrine really applies with an unheralded power, a statutory provision that an agency has long had at hand, but it suddenly found that it covers the case before.
I didn't catch the crucial word. A doctrine covers what?
A situation in which the agency has had a power, statutory provision, has long had that statutory provision and suddenly discovers that it covers a new case. That's where the major question doctrine has the most application. This is a new statute. Congress gave the commission a task, and the task was to adopt rules to prevent digital discrimination. The major part of it, it's clear that Congress gave the commission a significant task here. The major questions doctrine doesn't apply to the commission's contemporaneous or new interpretation of a statute that it just got, handed. We circle back to the real question, which is, what does the statute mean? What is the best reading of the statute? And you don't get out of that best reading by calling upon the major questions doctrine. If the best reading of the statute is that it covers disparate impact claims, then the fact that it's a big deal is that's what Congress's decision was. Congress gave the commission a big portfolio. And that's clear from the words, again, of the statute. Adopt within 2 years these rules to prevent digital discrimination of access to broadband internet access service. So I think the major questions doctrine doesn't have an application to this case. This case is a statutory interpretation case, pure and simple. And as I've explained, I think that when one looks at the statute, the entire statute, and it's not a very long statute, I think everybody agrees, yeah. It's all in there. When you look at the terms equal access and equal opportunity, when you take the significance of technical and economic feasibility, when you recognize that the statute tells the commission to prevent discrimination without saying, as other statutes do, no person shall or no employer shall, then all of those together, and the fact
that the arbitrary and capricious APA standard doesn't apply here.
Well, this is a question of statutory interpretation. So the question would be,
well, if the interpretation is arbitrary and capricious.
Well, that would mean, first of all, Your Honor, that you didn't agree with my interpretation of the statute, that it's the best reading. And then the second would have to be your.
All right. Nice semantics.
I don't mean to quibble, Your Honor. If you disagree with our argument, then obviously you're free to do so. But I think the question here is not whether it's arbitrary.
Well, I'm thinking of aspects like including people who are not broadband providers.
Well, I think that's
as broadly as it's defined in the rule. I mean, I can't imagine who that doesn't cover in some at least some circumstances.
So I'm glad you asked that question about the non-broadband providers, because I think that aspect of the order has been overblown. All the commission said was, our charge is to prevent digital discrimination of access to broadband service. Broadband providers are not the only people who can adversely affect access to broadband service.
So it doesn't even say adversely affect. It says affect.
Right, but
there you took out the adversely. Go ahead.
Well, but I think the intent was that, remember, you're talking about preventing, the commission is talking about preventing discrimination of access. So I think the adverse is, is included. But all the commission said was, look, the statute doesn't limit us. It doesn't say broadband internet access providers in Section B, subsection B. And it does say that elsewhere in the statute. It says it in D. It says prevent digital discrimination of access. And all the commission did was essentially observe, we're not going to take people who aren't technically broadband internet access providers off the table. If they have a close connection to the provision of broadband service, they may be able to cut it off just the same way the provider might.
Of course, you don't have the close connection in the rule itself, right?
Well, but the order explains what the commission meant by or how it would exercise potentially down the road a claim against a provider.
Before your time's gone, I do want you to, we're supposed to look at the whole statute, says the Supreme Court. And B2 says identifying, which sounds like studies and task force and government talk, necessary steps for the commission to take to eliminate the discrimination just described. So that sounds like down the road before you really do anything. How do you read B2, and doesn't that seem to say this can't be disparate impact and has to be just treatment?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think B2 is a separate, you're right, the commission was also, Congress also directed the commission to identify necessary steps to eliminate. But B1 talks about preventing. And B1 is a here and now, was a here and now instruction to the commission to adopt rules to preventing digital discrimination of access. The question is whether that preventing digital discrimination of access includes disparate impact claims. And as I've explained, the other indications suggest that the best reading of the statute is that it does include disparate impact claims. So
you have a stronger argument without B2, though, don't you?
Well, I think B1 and B2 are separate. They impose separate tasks on the commission, and I don't know that there's anything in B2 that, when it says discrimination described in paragraph 1, that it doesn't mean discrimination that includes disparate impact claims. So I just don't know that B2 moves the needle either way when what we're talking about. I guess I'm just trying to see whether there's anything else that I wanted to get through, but I think that if the court has no further questions, I think I've said my piece, and I'll allow my supporting intervener some time to talk. Thank you.
May it please the court, David Brody on behalf of intervener respondents. I'd like to make just a few quick points responding to some of the things we've heard from industry petitioners. First, with regard to inclusive communities, it's important to note that the holding and test from that case at page 533 says, quote, anti-discrimination laws must be construed to encompass disparate impact claims when the text refers to the consequences of actions and not just the mindset of actors, and where the interpretation is consistent with statutory purpose. All three of those factors are present or not present, respectively, here. Importantly, a lot has been made about the lack of the phrase otherwise makes unavailable, and so forth, as the Supreme Court relied on in inclusive communities and in Griggs and Smith. But inclusive communities also held that a provision covered disparate impact when it did not include that phrase. Inclusive communities looked at sections 804A and 805A of the Fair Housing Act, and only one of those provisions, 804A, uses the word otherwise. The other one does not, and the Supreme Court held that both cover disparate impact. Similarly, I think the Supreme Court's decision in Board of Education of New York versus Harris is highly instructive here. In that case, the court also emphasized that the otherwise phrase is not talismanic on its own, and to really look at the entirety of the statute. In particular, in Harris, the court put a lot of weight into the policy and purpose statements that Congress wrote into the text of the statute at issue. The court said at page 141 that, quote, the stated purpose of the legislation was the elimination, end quote, of discrimination and, quote, improving the quality of education for all children.
You would agree Harris has a strong flavor of legislative history and legislative history support, right, for what it says?
Yes, but legislative history is not necessary or appropriate to interpreting the text of the statute when Congress's intent is plain on the face of the statute, as it is here in subsection A of 1754. The important phrase is here is in A3, where Congress says that the commission, quote, the commission should take steps to ensure that all people of the United States benefit from equal access. That's an outcome. That's a goal. That's a result. And that's the same.
It acts like it's down the road, though, in the future, right? Take steps to ensure in the future.
It's certainly a place that Congress wants the FCC to get us to. That is a result.
Do you put any weight in the should, the verb is should there?
The verb there is, no, the verb, well, the verb, yes, it is
should take course, I'm pretty sure.
Yes, but it's a statement of policy, and the operative command to the commission is in the opening language of subsection B. And this is important to recognize. Subsection B1, which has the phrase preventing digital discrimination of access, that's a sentence fragment. It doesn't have a subject, a verb, or a direct object. That's not the command to the commission. The text, the operative text and command to the commission is in the opening of subsection B, where it says, the commission shall adopt final rules to facilitate equal access to broadband. Congress is telling the commission, achieve this outcome, achieve equal access to broadband. Later, after the technical and economic feasibility clause, it uses the word objective.
Facilitate is not achieve.
Equal access.
Achieve is not impossible, but Congress wouldn't insist achieve equal anything.
That's fair, Your Honor, but the question here is whether this language is looking at results or the mindset of actors. And there's nothing anywhere in the four corners of the text of this statute that talks about specific actors or their intent. In particular, when you look at the phrase preventing digital discrimination of access, that itself is a result, the prevention of discrimination, which in inclusive communities, the Supreme Court also said that
discrimination is intentional.
I don't think that's correct.
Well, it is.
It can be,
It is if we got 20 people off the street and asked them.
So, Your Honor,
the fact that your neighbor is richer than you are, is that and does that deprive you of equal access to wealth?
So, Your Honor, the Supreme Court said in inclusive communities, again relying on Harris and other things, that discrimination can encompass disparate impact. Harris said that the word discrimination can encompass disparate impact. And in Olmstead versus L.C. X. Rel. Zimring, Justice Thomas's dissent says that both disparate treatment and disparate impact are different forms of discrimination. So the word discrimination on its own doesn't have a talismanic significance here.
Except when you're skipping around the one phrase about disparate impact liability must be limited, which you're textual here, you've read it. But you have skipped around that, and that does kind of tilt it if it's 50-50 toward disparate treatment.
So in inclusive communities, the Supreme Court said that there have to be these constitutional guardrails and the ability for respondents to present defenses, and that is what Congress has done here with the technical and economic feasibility framing. It's saying, Congress is saying, that's the defense that broadband providers or whomever can afford themselves of. And in inclusive communities, the court was clear that there is not one formulation of what that defense needs to be structured as, so long as there is this opportunity to assert those types of legitimate interests and address less discriminatory alternatives. In inclusive communities, the court talked about how the framework from Title VII doesn't necessarily fit with the Fair Housing Act. Here, Congress has exercised its prerogative to say what it thinks the appropriate interests are that should be accounted for in the disparate evaluation. And that phrase, technical and economic feasibility, it just wouldn't make sense in a disparate treatment context. Because as the Supreme Court said in inclusive communities, if technical and economic feasibility, if those types of things are your motivation is not a protected characteristic. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Ms. Ratner, are you going to take the remaining time?
I will, yes. Thank you, Your Honor. So a quick cleanup point and then four responses to their main textual arguments. The quick cleanup point is, of course, the Commission does not get deference here after Loper-Bright. Loper-Bright carved out express circumstances where discretion is given by statute to define a characteristic. The statute here does not say the Commission gets to define discrimination. It just gives it rulemaking authority, which is exactly the circumstance in which Chevron would have applied when an agency has rulemaking authority. Now, onto the textual points, four of them. First, they say equal access and equal opportunity objectives get you to the results. That's not right for several reasons. One, that could be true of virtually every non-discrimination provision. The goal is always equality. If we have a goal of equality and that's enough to make it a disparate impact statute, then all non-discrimination statutes become disparate impact. 42 U.S.C. 1981 talks about full and equal benefits. The Equal Protection Clause talks about equal protection. The Digital Equity Act talks about digital equity. Those are all disparate treatment provisions. That's not a relevant signal, which is why it was not a signal that was called out by the Supreme Court in inclusive communities. This is woefully short of the results-oriented language there that the court said had to be in the operative provision. And I think that's really important here. This is a goal of facilitating equal access. Judge Loken, as you recognized, helping equal access. And then B1 says, here's one way to do it. Eliminate front-end barriers from discrimination. We are talking only about that one way to do it and what it means. Second argument they make is technical and economic feasibility. Of course, nobody says that that's irrelevant to disparate treatment. And in fact, the Commission said just the opposite, pages 67 to 68 and 105 of the Joint Appendix. The argument is just that it has a lesser role for disparate treatment. Well, a lesser role does not make surplusage, and they need it to be surplusage to be a meaningful textual argument here. Again, it's also relevant that that constraint is part of an umbrella command. There may be a number of other rules, all of which are bound by technical and economic feasibility, and that may be a more important or less important constraint depending on the rule at issue. Third argument they make is that this doesn't start with a prohibition on a particular actor. That is virtually, if not common, that is true of virtually all of the disparate impact statutes that we know. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, Title IX, the Digital Equity Act, Section 1981, they all talk about a person shouldn't be denied the benefits of or denied equal treatment, denied equal participation. They very rarely talk about the actor doing the denying. So the framing in the passive voice is a completely irrelevant relevant clue here. Fourth, there's this textual argument, or perhaps the rebuttal to our textual argument about the meaning of discrimination. We say, look, discrimination, the Supreme Court has said time and time again, Jackson against Birmingham, Murray against UBS, Babb against Wilkie, plenty of others, that the normal meaning is differential treatment, same as the person on the street would say. And they say, well, look, in the few disparate impact cases we have, the word discrimination appeared there too. I think that cuts exactly the other way. In every one of those cases, the word discrimination, the court understood 9-0 in cases like Smith, Griggs, Inclusive Communities, to be disparate treatment. And then there were additional portions of the non-discrimination ban, additional language that the court said, we have disparate treatment in the ban on discrimination, and now we're moving to something else with other results-oriented language, like don't adversely affect people, don't make things unavailable. And it's that separate language that the court said is disparate impact. So there is, just to be very clear, no case where the only thing we have is a ban on discrimination, and discrimination is understood to encompass both disparate treatment and disparate impact. That's what they're asking for here. Final point.
805A in the Inclusive Communities case itself.
Sure. So the court considered really 805A and 804 together, and I think that's why it's a little confusing, but that's why they say there is disparate treatment, and then the otherwise make unavailable moves it to disparate impact. So as I read the opinion, it's that separate language, the otherwise make unavailable, where the court located the disparate impact. It did not say the word discriminate here means disparate impact on its own. They probably could have been a little clearer on the 804, 805 relation, but at least reading pages 534 to 535, I think that's the best understanding. Just a final point, the commission says that the major questions doctrine shouldn't apply because this hasn't been some sort of long dormant provision. That is not a prerequisite in the Supreme Court's cases. In fact, in the student loan case, Nebraska against Biden, that was a provision that had been applied many times. The point was it was being applied in that circumstance in an extremely broad way. And if we're going to talk about unheralded opinions, unheralded provisions, it's hard for me to see one more than the single provision tacked on at the end of a 1,000-page omnibus spending bill that didn't have a single line of debate or discussion in the legislature. So for that reason, we ask you to set this aside. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. These are important cases, well argued by everybody. You've done a great job of, within the time allowed, of making us better understand the key issues in the case and the respective positions that each of you is advocating. And we'll take the consolidated cases under advisement and do our best with them. Court is in